Hi, everyone. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway, broadcasting from WKSU Studios in Kent, Ohio, on the campus of Kent State University. And we'll be here today and tomorrow, and we're so glad you're with us. All week, we've been talking about the big business behind U.S. detention centers. Many of them are private companies who contract with the federal government. And today, we focus on Southwest Key Programs, a nonprofit organization that's the biggest provider of housing for migrant children in the U.S. Southwest Key made big profits off of the Trump administration's hardline immigration policies. But in December, the New York Times reported on financial mismanagement within the company. And this week, Southwest Key announced that Juan Sanchez, the group's longtime CEO, would be stepping down as a result of a subsequent investigation into the group's finances. But while Southwest Key was the biggest example of the enormous profits generated by housing migrants, immigrant detention is also a moneymaker for private contractors across multiple government agencies. Kim Barker is here, and she was part of the team that broke this story for the New York Times. And we also have Catherine Hawkins, an investigator at the Project on Government Oversight. Welcome to you both.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Kim, can you tell us what happened on Monday? How did we learn about Juan Sanchez stepping down from Southwest Key?
Well, I learned because somebody slipped me an email, but the rest of us learned because they put out a press release saying that the board had asked or had said that Juan was stepping down, and Juan also put out a statement about stepping down from the charity. And what's remarkable about this is a charity that he was very identified with. He started the charity himself out of his mother's home, actually, 32 years ago, and he's been at the helm ever since. So it's not like simply a transition of a company, one person stepping down and another person coming on. It's a huge deal for the nonprofit and in the industry in general.
And Kim, we had you on the show here on The Takeaway back in June to talk a little bit about this organization and Mr. Sanchez. Can you remind us who Juan Sanchez is and basically how he made Southwest Key what it is today?
Sure. Mr. Sanchez was born into a very working class, poor family in Brownsville near the border with Mexico. And he grew up, you know, sleeping on the floor of his two-bedroom house. He was the oldest son, you know, seven kids in the family. And he became the first in his family to actually go to college, and he made it all the way to Harvard. And he was always very interested in the idea of juvenile justice and keeping juveniles out of prisons and facilities. So he actually started Southwest Key about 32 years ago to focus on that, to focus on issues of juvenile justice. And then, you know, as the crisis grew and shrank with migrant children coming across the border, he was one of the first to get his charity involved in that. And it was a very haphazard system from the very beginning. And, you know, they just sort of grew and grew, and he became the biggest provider, and Southwest Key was the biggest provider. And it wasn't really until 2013 that he burst on the national scene because of what was happening nationally with the crisis. And that's really when everybody knew, learned about what was happening.
Catherine, I want to bring you in here for a second because I'm curious. We're seeing a lot of public-private partnerships, and here on The Takeaway, we've been reporting this week on this interaction of these two entities. When did the government start contracting out the care of migrant children to private companies and nonprofits like Southwest Key?
So it has been largely nonprofits, but as the number of migrant children increased, an increasing percentage of it went away from more traditional nonprofits like Catholic Charities and Lutheran Social Services, and to Southwest Key, which is technically a nonprofit, but operated a lot more like a for-profit company.
And how has the Trump administration's change in immigration policy basically changed this relationship?
The Trump administration, in addition to zero tolerance and family separation, which sent a lot more kids into the system, including younger children, they also made a change where that, in general, the Department of Health and Human Services tries to hold children in shelters as short a time as possible so they can be transferred to a sponsor, usually a family member. The Trump administration changed the rules for placement with family members so that information about the potential sponsor and, at one point last year, all of the adults living in the sponsor's household could be sent to ICE and they could arrest someone for being in the United States unlawfully. So this obviously had a major chilling effect on people applying to sponsor children, and so the amount of time children have spent in these shelters has gone up dramatically.
And Kim, I'm wondering, is Southwest Key still under investigation here? And if so, what's the status of that investigation?
I mean, you're never going to know about an investigation, right? That's always the line from the authorities. If we're investigating, we're not going to talk about the investigation. I know after the story that we did in December, we found out the Justice Department was investigating possible financial malfeasance at the organization. And from talking to people inside, they say that that's ongoing. There also was an internal investigation that was launched by Southwest Key after the story, and they hired an outside firm, a very reputable firm, to take a look at what was happening inside the charity. And it's not just Mr. Sanchez that has decided to step down. It's also the chief financial officer, Melody Chung, left last month. So there's real turmoil going on at the organization.
Catherine, even though there are different agencies for how the government deals with migrant adults and children, what do these institutions have in common, whether they're for-profit or nonprofit, as you said, are the majority here?
I think one thing they have in common is that they're heavily privatized. Another thing that I think NPR has reported on is that when children hit their 18th birthday in detention at a shelter, they are actually put in handcuffs and sent to an adult detention facility run by ICE. There's also been, you know, problems with oversight and accountability in both systems.
Kim, what does Sanchez's departure here at Southwest Key, how will that impact or will it impact the amount of children who are still being detained by the government?
I don't know that it will affect that. There's a certain amount of children coming in, and there's only certain places that will take them. And, you know, Southwest Key has a huge infrastructure set up to do this. It's not like Juan was running an individual shelter or anything like that. And the interim CEO they have is from inside the company. I think that where we'll really see what happens is with this Justice Department investigation and also with what the Southwest Key Board decides to do. If they actually decide to bring in somebody from outside to run this charity, or if they decide to stick with somebody who's been there, you know, since the beginning of their career. I think that's, we'll see what happens when they make those decisions.
And Kim, is there a similar lack of oversight or financial malfeasance, if you will, with other nonprofit contractors in this space, or is Southwest Key unique here?
From my understanding, what's happened is that in 2013 and 2014, there was just such an explosion of unaccompanied migrant children coming over the border who needed places to go. And so the priority was finding places for them to go. And that's why Southwest Key really exploded during that time, setting up these huge shelters that were more like, you know, institutions for 300, 400. They set up one last year that can serve 1,400 kids, a former Walmart in Brownsville. And during this period of time, I think the priority was finding these places and getting food for these kids and sheltering these kids. It wasn't necessarily looking at the money. And I think that's now what the federal government is trying to do. In fact, they told us in November, as we were preparing to go to print with a story, that they were doing a forensic accounting review of all the different providers to see how they're spending their money. And in fact, one charity lost all of its funding about a year ago because of doing things very similar to what Southwest Key has done.
Hey, Kim, we were hearing stories almost on a weekly basis of what migrant children are dealing with, everything from potential for sexual abuse on up. Is the federal government even equipped to keep track of how these companies are doing business?
I mean, I think it's very difficult when you're contracting this job out, especially when kids are involved.
In terms of the landscape in the state of Texas, where a lot of this seems to be happening, if Southwest Key is in this mess that they're in right now, is there the potential for other companies to come in and take advantage of this as a business opportunity?
I mean, the one company, and this is a for-profit company that has already come into this space, is named CHS, and they're a Florida company. They run the very large Florida Influx Center. And they also took over three shelters in the Brownsville area already. So in the last year, they've really moved into the space. And they're the only, you know, provider I can see that has enough infrastructure to take over any shelter if Southwest Key were to have problems.
And how does that change the landscape? Because I think one of the things we're sort of seeing here are an increase in public and private partnerships. And is that something that you think could be a positive or not?
I mean, I don't know. No, There's been a reason, like, and I don't know if it's a moral or philosophical reason, that for decades it's only been charities in this space. And, you know, in the beginning it was largely religious charities that would run these really small homes, you know, maybe a group home for 40 kids or so. And now it's big business. So I think anytime you look at the privatization of these sort of centers, the idea that where money making becomes the real driving force, that can be problematic. It can mean shortcuts. And that's what we, you know, that we've been looking at that with Southwest Key, being as they had operated so much more like a for-profit than a traditional charity.
Kim Barker is a reporter for The New York Times, and Catherine Hawkins is an investigator at the Project on Government Oversight. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
We reached out to the Department of Health and Human Services Administration for Children and Families, and in response, they said, quote, "This is an operational decision by Southwest Key Programs, and as such, the Office of Refugee Resettlement in HHS's Administration for Children and Families has no comment." Later on the show, we'll be talking about the Varsity Blues scandal and what it reveals about money and privilege in the college admissions process. And we reached out to you. What was your college admissions process like? Did you get any help? And if so, were you honest about it?
Hi, my name is Julia Sandage. I'm from Eugene, Oregon. I am a graduate of the University of Colorado at Boulder. I was the first generation in my family to attend college, so I had no help, no one to guide me.
Hi, this is Pat from Southern California. Yes, I was honest in my college admissions. It was the 1970s, and my counselors all tried to get me to claim my Native American ancestry or lineage, despite it being only an eighth or something. I do remember a very wealthy uncle in L.A. who had both of his kids going to USC on complete financial aid, no loans. When I asked him how they did it, my uncle replied to me that it was all in how you fill out the forms. So they just lied. Nobody seemed to care.
Reina Olivas from Houston, Texas. I didn't have any kind of prep for the SATs or the ACTs, and I still managed to be ranked 15 out of 600 kids in my high school. And I was admitted into UT Austin. And there were conversations in some of my classes or around campus when I was there that, you know, kids like me were only there because of affirmative action. And it really, really messed with my head. And it still does.
Always happy to hear your thoughts. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway.
I want to share my experience with someone. I don't want them to forget about Aubrey and Abe. I want people to say their names.
Tasha Smith lives in Cleveland, Ohio, and that experience she's referring to is losing her twin newborns.
I called the doctor. The doctor said, don't panic, but come in immediately. Minutes into getting hooked up to the machines and everything, I was alerted that Aubrey's heartbeat was no longer beating.
Tasha had to deliver Aubrey and Abe at 23 weeks. Abe died just days after birth. Aubrey was stillborn.
And they asked me, did I want to see Aubrey? Of course I wanted to see Aubrey because I wanted to see what she looked like. So they brought me Aubrey, and it was the hardest thing to see. She was beautiful. Most beautiful little girl you could ever see, just looked like she was sleeping. Strong features to be 1 pound and 4 ounces.
In 2017, there were more than 850 known stillbirths here in Ohio. So Tasha's not alone in the experience. But the racial divide is staggering. Twice as many black babies are stillborn as white in Ohio. According to the CDC, national numbers are similar. And yet, as racial discrepancies in infant mortality overall get more national attention, it's something we've covered quite a bit on this show, stillbirths are less often discussed. But talking about it may be just what's needed to ease that specific trauma that women like Tasha go through. Anne Glosser is managing producer of health and education for WCPN Cleveland, and she's been reporting on this. Anne, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, thanks for having me.
The clips that we just heard are really powerful and painful. What started you on this reporting line?
Well, I was speaking with a chaplain from our local hospital system, and he mentioned that, you know, a lot of women go through the stillbirth process alone because, you know, you still have to deliver the baby. And so that got me started thinking, what's this experience like, right? And so then I dug into the data a little bit and really found that the stillbirth numbers are on par with the infant mortality rate, which, you know, we hear an infant mortality rate, that is all the babies that die within the first year of life but are born alive, right? So it does not include stillbirth deaths. So the numbers of stillbirths were very significant. And we hear a lot about the infant mortality numbers, but not a lot about the stillbirth numbers. So I really wanted to dig in and talk about that.
And remind us again the difference, what a stillbirth is.
So a stillbirth is when a baby dies in utero, right? And when a baby dies within their first year of life, that's considered infant mortality, but they need to be born alive to be counted in that statistic.
Now, again, we know that there are discrepancies in race in terms of infant mortality. Black babies have a higher likelihood of dying than white babies do. But what is driving the stillbirth discrepancy here?
Well, we're not sure. And again, you know, as with infant mortality, we know that the racial disparity cuts across all socioeconomic factors, right? And so researchers are pointing to this idea of toxic stress, and they're still trying to grapple with what's going on here in our infant mortality numbers. And what we know is that, at least here locally, preterm births are really driving that infant mortality rate, and that's definitely associated with stillbirth figures as well. So we think that there's some speculation that there might be something to do with the stress that's going on there in women's lives.
And you also spoke to experts about specific trauma that this can have, the impact that this can have on mothers. Let's hear from one of the grief counselors you spoke to.
Some moms develop what we call post-traumatic stress syndrome because they've all of this different things that's going on. They actually, you know, see their baby dead, a lot of blood and different stuff. So they have flashbacks and they try to avoid even thinking about the baby.
Is that what you heard from other mothers, Anne?
We did hear this from a lot of women that we worked with for a bigger series that we were working on about trauma and loss within the African-American community here in Cleveland. And it's really a profound experience, right? One of the folks I spoke with for this story called it, such a deep experience that sometimes women don't have words to describe it. And it's something that a lot of times it creates this grief that's just not acknowledged by society because, you know, you're supposed to come home with a baby and then you don't, and then people don't know how to talk with you about it, and you're sort of just supposed to get over it. And it's not like when your grandma dies or something and that's openly acknowledged and discussed and, you know, you're supported by your social networks. There's something different, at least according to the people that I was talking with for this story, about the stillbirth experience, because society doesn't like to talk about dead babies.
Let's talk a little bit about what is being done, if anything, to help mothers like Tasha.
So Ohio did create a partnership with this nonprofit organization called Count the Kicks that made patient education materials available to health professionals and did a lot of outreach there. The idea there being that encouraging mothers, pregnant mothers, to count the kicks, count the number of times their baby kicks. And the idea being that if the kick count goes lower, that would signal trouble and you could go and get into the hospital earlier and maybe help prevent a stillbirth. But the evidence there is a little mixed on whether that's effective. A 2015 Cochrane review found that it didn't help. And recently, the new governor of Ohio has an increased focus on home visits for pregnant women and new mothers. And this is, you know, an evidence-based way to decrease infant mortality, which may have some effect on stillbirths. And also there's, you know, some smoking cessation programs and chronic disease management programs and family planning and pregnancy spacing initiatives, because if you space out your pregnancies a little bit further, then your body has more time to recover and better chance of having a healthier pregnancy.
You mentioned earlier that people don't like talking about, in your words, dead babies. Why is that? What is there a cultural issue here? Is this a piece of our just general social fabric that makes us uncomfortable? What is happening where we don't talk about this enough?
One thing that we encountered a lot with this series that we were doing was trying to look at this taboo and examine it and see whether it is helpful for us. Because what we heard a lot from the community is that for women who are ready to speak about their loss experience, that it can be healing.
Ann Glosser is a reporter and managing producer of health and education for WCPN Cleveland. Ann, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Hey, Takeaway listeners, Amy Walter here, host of Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway. Every week, I'll take you beyond the headlines for a deeper understanding of how Washington works, who's pulling the levers of power, and how it all impacts you. I hope you'll check it out. Just search for Politics with Amy Walter in your podcast app and subscribe. Happy listening.
For the past 6 days, Venezuelans have been without power after a plant that provides electricity to the majority of the country stopped working. The blackout has escalated tensions in Venezuela, where citizens are increasingly going without food, water, and other basic supplies. And on Monday, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced that the State Department would withdraw all of its remaining personnel from the Venezuelan embassy. Previously, the United States had kept diplomats in Caracas with the hopes of bolstering support for opposition leader Juan Guaido. How the move will affect U.S. policy in Venezuela going forward remains unclear. Joining us now from Venezuela is Andrew Rosati, a reporter for Bloomberg in Caracas. Andrew, we're speaking to you via phone, and that's why the sound quality is what it is, but also because of these ongoing blackouts, so we appreciate that. What's the scene like there today?
Parts of Caracas and parts of the country are still without power after the lights went out last Thursday. Much of it in the capital has come back, though, and people are starting to go back to their lives, you know, taking stock of rotting food, trying to get water and gasoline. There's still a big sense of confusion in the city and a big sense of frustration for many as the lights have not gone back on. The big issue now in Caracas is because the power is back but not strong enough, the water pumps that bring water to the city are not functioning at full capacity. So there are thousands and thousands of Venezuelans without water. Yesterday, all across the city, you could see people with jugs going to mountainside springs and bursted pipes trying to find water either to use for bathing purposes or flush toilets. But the big fear now is not just lights, but how they're going to get water moving forward. Because when the lights went out, many of these residents wouldn't have any other services either.
On Tuesday, Venezuela's chief prosecutor announced that they would investigate whether or not Juan Guaido, the opposition leader, played a role in these power outages. Andrew, is this political, and as are so many things happening in Venezuela today, or is there a reason to believe that Guaido could have been behind the power outages?
The hard part about figuring out the source of problems in Venezuela is that every time there is a infrastructure or economical or health problem, the ruling government here often blames sabotage or foul play by its opponents. To be clear, power outages are very common in Venezuela, especially in the interior of the country. There are major cities in Venezuela that the lights go out for hours, if not a day at a time. And the same thing with running water. It's always on the fritz here. But this blackout, there's nothing that in living memory has been anywhere close to this, where so much of the country has been plunged into darkness. But many Venezuelans I can speak to on the ground are very skeptical of this, because for so long the government has struggled to keep the lights and the water running.
When there is a blackout, generally, after even a couple of hours, desperation starts to set in. Andrew, what are you seeing as far as, you mentioned the lack of water right now. Are Venezuelans safe?
This is a really big health issue right now. Again, Venezuela will, at major cities and in the capital, it's not uncommon for water to go on the fritz for days at a time, you know, and many Venezuelans, and myself included, will have some type of reserve system, have a massive tank in my apartment. But because this has dragged on for so long, desperation is now setting in. But even so, as this is dragging on, tempers are rising. We're seeing sporadic protests across Caracas. Residents are blocking major highways and roadways. Some cases burning tires. You know, the response to this has been sending water trucks out through the city, and the government has promised that the water and full power will be restored shortly. But the scenes across Caracas were almost heartbreaking yesterday. You see everywhere you see, you see people covering, you know, water jugs with them or strapped to the back of motorcycles and flatbed trucks. Just, no one has a sense when this will be restored. The government said that power was supposed to be restored yesterday, but they extended the wait period up for another 3 days. So there's a sense of skepticism, frustration, and again, desperation.
Andrew, we mentioned at the top of the segment that the United States had decided to withdraw U.S. diplomats from Venezuela this week. Secretary Pompeo on Twitter said that the presence of U.S. diplomatic staff at the embassy has become a constraint on U.S. policy. Can you give us a sense of what Secretary Pompeo means, and what does it mean for the United States to make this withdrawal now?
President Trump and the State Department have repeatedly said that all options are on the table. Now, what a constraint on having diplomatic staff here is not yet clear. There is one answer that could be is that, you know, it is becoming very hard to live in Venezuela at this point. And areas without generators are completely left on their own. You know, people are putting their children to bed by candlelight every night. If you don't have a direct gas line, cooking becomes a huge issue. Even those that have generators now, whether it be hospitals, hotels, restaurants, you know, the big issue now is diesel fuel, and then now water to cool the engines down. So everything is becoming unstable. So some analysts believe that it's just simply too hard to keep U.S. diplomats in Venezuela. The other is that there could be an escalation in U.S. policy moving forward. You know, whether there is a tightening up of sanctions. Already the U.S. has sanctions on Venezuela's all-important oil industry, but it's not a full embargo, like similar to what is happening in Cuba. President Trump and members of the State Department, the National Security Advisors, have repeatedly said that all options on the table. And so if there could be there's a fear for many that there's some military action could be in the future, even though we've seen denials by some members.
Andrew Rosati is a reporter for Bloomberg based in Caracas. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
Photoshopping teenagers to show them playing a sport they've never tried, bribing college entrance exam proctors to alter scores, sending wire transfers to NCAA coaches. Well, it's all part of the allegations from an FBI investigation called Operation Varsity Blues.
These parents are a catalog of wealth and privilege. They include, for example, CEOs of private and public companies, successful securities and real estate investors, two well-known actresses, a famous fashion designer, and the co-chairman of a global law firm. Based on the charges, all of them knowingly conspired to help their children either cheat on the SAT or ACT and/or buy their children's admission to elite schools through fraud.
Federal prosecutors charged more than 30 wealthy parents with spending millions of dollars on bribery and fraud. And at the heart of the investigation is a private college prep company known as The Key. On Tuesday, U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling described one way that Brian Singer, founder of The Key, was able to get students into schools by using athletics.
The coaches worked with Singer, meaning they accepted bribes. Singer gave the coaches sufficiently impressive fake athletic credentials. The coaches used those athletic profiles to convince everyone else internally that this was a good recruit for the team. The person was admitted, and the coach pocketed a bribe. Some simply never showed up for the athletics. Some pretended an injury, and I think some played briefly and then quit.
Now, this all sounds pretty outrageous, but wealthy parents spending big bucks to get their kids into top schools isn't anything new, and sadly, it's usually perfectly legal. But there are kids who can't afford to keep up, and those are the ones that are often left behind. Natasha Wariku is an associate professor of education at Harvard University and the author of The Diversity Bargain. Natasha, great to have you back on the show.
Great to be back.
So let's take a step back here. I mean, this case has gotten a ton of attention because of the big names in Hollywood and really these details of photoshopping your kids' faces on photo. I mean, this is just so much to take in. But let's talk a little bit about the other ways that wealthy parents help their kids get into top schools. We've heard a lot about parents buying a building or buying a wing. How do they do this?
Yeah, so I think, you know, I think it's important to keep in mind that any parent will do whatever they can to support their children's success, right? And some parents have more means than others to do so. So, you know, the thing about a building, you know, there are ways in which the development office can go to the admissions office and say, the development office being the office that raises money for a university, will go to the admissions office and say, you know, this person's family is, you know, buying a building or doing this. And can you take a close look, a very close look at this application? And, you know, I think Jared Kushner's admission to Harvard is sort of the classic example of that. But that this happens every year for all of these elite places. You know, and I think there are other, you know, more subtle ways that this happens as well. So legacy admissions, you know, universities talk about how they give, again, a second and a third look, an additional read to applicants whose parents went to that university because they say that fosters loyalty to the university. And what they're really talking about is, again, donations to the university. So it's a way of ensuring that the financial well-being of the university.
Well, Natasha, but I absolutely want to dig into the issue here of legacy students and also talk a little bit about affirmative action, because really what this comes down to, and we know broadly in the United States, this is about wealth. It's not just about money. It's about wealth. And
yes.
If your parent, you know, I take your point that any parent would do whatever they need to do to support the success of their children getting into the best schools that they can. Here, however, we're talking about fairness.
Yes.
If I am a parent who can afford to buy a building or a wing or whatever it is that I can afford to buy, or, you know, have a grandparent who went to the school, that really changes the dynamic here. And the majority of those kids, I'm going to take a wild guess, and not even a guess, but based on data, that those children are white and privileged. So how does that
Yes.
play into this?
Absolutely. I mean, I think what's fair is a whole other question. I would absolutely agree with you. That is patently unfair, right? It's unfair that families who have resources can use money to help their children get into these elite places, especially when we have this idea that, you know, these are meritocratic processes and that everybody has a fair shake at getting into these places. And the reality is that that's not true. But I also think that we need to think about how we define fairness and what's fair, because I don't think there is a consensus in the United States on what is fair and unfair. You know, I think this case of, like, doctoring, photoshopping and all of that, I think everybody would agree it's unfair. I think even those parents would say, yeah, this was wrong, this is unfair, but I did it, right? But I think all these other practices, it's a lot more murky. So, you know, there's probably
Natasha, I just want to push back there a little bit, because it's murky, but it's murky because these are systems that have been put in place and they revolve around money. I want to, you know, we've seen a lot of pushback, and I've reported on this, and there have been other folks that have reported on the pushback, for example, against affirmative action, the idea that someone who is underprivileged or from a less represented background, a person of color, a woman, for example, might potentially, you know, have an advantage because of their disadvantage, quote unquote, if you will. That pushback doesn't seem to be happening against legacy students, against this other type of really sort of gaming the system for wealthy elite kids.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think it's very interesting that there's so much public discussion about, you know, is affirmative action fair, when, you know, this is a policy that has, you know, historically was designed to promote equity, right? And we know that legacy admissions is something that promotes inequality, right? And so, but it's become, you know, affirmative action has become such a hot button issue, and I think it's incredibly problematic. And so I think, you know, we really need to think about what is the goal of admissions? What are we trying to to do here. If we're trying to increase equality of opportunity in the United States and ensure that everyone has a fair chance, then that leads to, you know, different ways of thinking about admissions and fairness than I think what most of the elite colleges are doing right now.
When we talk about legacy admissions, Natasha, we interviewed Glenn Singleton, who is a former admissions officer at the University of Pennsylvania. And he talked about, you know, how this issue can really impact student admissions.
When I look at the legacy factor, okay, sometimes I can't explain that. But what I do know is that when the institution is generous to the sons and daughters of its alumni, then those alumni tend to be more generous to the institution.
Your response to that, Natasha, when we talk about fairness?
Well, first, the evidence for that is unclear. I think Richard Kahlenberg has done some studies of alumni donation, and it suggests that it's not clear that the university is actually getting money through these considerations. And I would say that even if the universities do, that it's pretty patently unfair to children whose parents are not privileged. And so if we, you know, if we hold up these universities as sort of our bastions of meritocracy and fairness and opportunity, then I think it's incredibly problematic to privilege kids of, you know, kids who are already incredibly privileged by having parents who are very familiar with that university in particular and elite education in general and have a bachelor's degree. You know, we forget that most adults in the United States don't have a bachelor's degree and so can't guide their kids in the same ways. And so I think it's patently unfair and it's unfair and it promotes inequality. And I think these universities have to really take a hard look at that policy and why they continue to defend that policy.
Natasha Warico is an associate professor of education at Harvard University and author of The Diversity Bargain. Natasha, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.